All right, if everyone could make their way to their seats, we're going to have our keynote presentation now. Clive Willmer is going to speak to you. You had a bit of an introduction. I mentioned the Guild in my talk, and when I introduced John, John spoke a lot more about the Guild and the projects in the Wire Forest. Clive is the current Master of the Guild of St. George. We're delighted to have him here. He's come a long way to speak to us. He's going to speak to us on a new road on which the world should travel, John Ruskin, The Nature of Gothic, and William Morris. So really drawing those two strands of our day together here. And I hope you'll, I know, I've heard Clive speak, so I know that you will thoroughly enjoy his talk. And afterwards, we'll have a discussion here as a panel, and we hope that you'll stay and take part in that discussion. And we also hope to talk to you more about the Guild and its work, since this day is actually co-sponsored by the Guild and the Hillside Club. So if you're interested in learning more about what we're doing in the Guild, we'd love to talk to you about that. And we also have some pamphlets in the back that give you more information. Okay, and I'll turn the podium over to Clive now.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I'd just like to, you know, before I get going, I'd like to say thank you to everybody for your welcome here and to say how delighted I am to be on the other side of the pond and sharing these ideas, which I think are very important to our lives today, with you. And John was talking beautifully, I thought, about one side of the work we do, which is, if you like, the practical side of living in the world. And this actual event itself represents the other side of what we do, which is thinking about living in the world. And the two things belong together. And the image of the Wire Forest that John's just given you, of the, you know, Ruskin's unfulfilled dream of having an art gallery in a forest, unlikely idea that it is a sort of image of what we're trying to do, trying to bring those different sides of life together to try and make us whole again in our wounded world. So that's the business of the Guild and St. George. I'm going to talk about Ruskin and Morris now, but all of that is behind what I say. I'd also just like to say that a number of people have said very nice things to me about the Guild and these occasions and have expressed an interest in seeing the land that John runs for us. And I'd like to sort of extend an invitation. I know this is a bit unrealistic, but we have an annual open day at Bewdley now in the Wire Forest, and it's on the 11th of July. So if any of you were going to be in England on the 11th of July, or were able to shift your present plans in that direction, you would be very welcome. And if you come and speak to me or John afterwards, we will give you our cards and you can get in touch with us by email. And you will be very welcome to come see the Wire Forest and the activity of the Guild there and to share a few glasses of wine and eat a barbecue and generally enjoy yourselves. We also have the annual general meeting of the Guild of St. George in Sheffield on the 15th of November in the gallery where we have Ruskin's collection. And you'd be very welcome on the same terms to come to that too. If you do, you will have an opportunity to hear our friend Professor Gray Breakin, who you heard this morning, coming over to become a companion of the Guild and talking about Ruskin and the New Deal, Ruskin's influence on Roosevelt. So those are two dates for your diaries, 15th of November and the 11th of July. But I'm going to talk about the nature of Gothic. And I'm going to start in that place I've just mentioned, Sheffield. As Master of the Guild, I have to go to Sheffield rather often because it was in that city that Ruskin established what he called St. George's Museum, an educational art collection created and funded by himself as a philanthropic act. Sheffield is the fourth largest city in Britain, one of those sprawling northern cities, largely made by the harsh fact of the Industrial Revolution, their character still to some extent determined by that fact. As recently as 1937, George Orwell could say of Sheffield that it was, quote, that it could, quote, justly claim to be called the ugliest town in the old world. That, I'm happy to say, is no longer the case, but you can still see how it might have been so, and the city remains defiantly unpretty. At the same time, it was never so simple as that. Someone once said, and I've never been able to find out who this was, but a number of people attribute it to Ruskin himself, someone once said that Sheffield was an ugly picture in a beautiful frame. I think there's a good reason to invite Tim Holton to Sheffield to check that one out. But the beautiful frame, of course, is the countryside, the spectacular countryside of the English Peak District, which surrounds Sheffield and which can be seen from almost any point in the city where you stand. And it was undoubtedly that characteristic which attracted Ruskin, who wanted to bring beauty of other kinds to people normally deprived of it. It was a landscape that he loved, but there was something else that meant almost as much to him. Unlike the other great industrial cities, Sheffield was a major manufacturing centre long before the Industrial Revolution. It started, as far as we can tell, in the 15th century, and by the 17th century, it was already a major producer of knives and forks and spoons, and became a centre for metalwork production, and by the end of the 18th century was world famous for its cutlery. Though badly hit by the recent financial crash, Sheffield remains an important centre for metalwork industries today. Before the advent of mass production, Sheffield cutlery was made by what Sheffield people call little mesters. That's to say, self-employed craftsmen who rented space for themselves in factories or worked from their own workshops. Mester is, of course, a dialect word for master, master craftsman, as we might say. And the workmanship of the mesters survived throughout the Industrial Revolution, was in a sense incorporated into it, and has not entirely disappeared today. These large northern cities, like their American equivalents, are now post-industrial and have struggled to sustain their economies and keep a sense of identity and purpose. Sheffield has been more successful than most in doing this. And it's interesting to me as Master of the Guild to notice in passing conversations how Ruskin and his legacy to Sheffield are well remembered there. The old craftsmanship, too, is well remembered. It does indeed, to some extent, survive. There are one or two very elderly men who persist in their craft. And recently, there has been something of a revival. On the visit I began by mentioning, I was taken to the workshop of one of these new mesters. His name... Oh, dear, what's happened? Did I hit the wrong thing? The name of the craftsman in question is Stuart Mitchell, and his workshop is in a fine old Victorian factory currently being restored as a complex of workshops. It's called Portland Works and is, as a matter of incidental interest, the place where stainless steel was invented just over 100 years ago by a man who, curiously enough, regarded himself as a follower of Ruskin's, Harry Brearley. I seem to have lost a page, I'm sorry. Here it is. Here is an example of Stuart Mitchell's work, a knife, sort of general purpose knife, which a forester might use or a backpacker might take on a long expedition. I've held one of these knives in my hand. And I can assure you, it is a thing of beauty. Now, this is not a throwback to a romantic age of craftsmanship. Mitchell uses all the modern equipment and materials that will serve his purpose. The handle, for instance, is made of a synthetic composite, and the blade is stainless steel. Neither Ruskin nor William Morris, in purist mode, would have been at first sight very much in favour. Nevertheless, in my conversation with Mitchell, I was reminded of Ruskin. For though Mitchell uses up-to-date machinery, he eschews mass production or anything that separates the craftsman from the object he is working on. Each knife is produced by Mitchell working alone, and for measure and design, he relies entirely on the judgment of hand and eye. He believes that hand and eye achieve better, more sensitive, more efficient, and more beautiful results than are possible with any mechanical measure. And as a result, no two knives from his workshop are ever identical. This means, he said to me, that no knife I make is perfect. A perfect knife would not be a good knife. Now, if you didn't know much about Ruskin before you came on this day, you will surely by now recognize that nothing could be more Ruskinian than that statement. Ruskin's great essay, The Nature of Gothic, which is placed near the midpoint of the Stones of Venice, 1851 to 53, Ruskin there speaks of the necessary imperfection of human constructs, and of that imperfection being paradoxically their glory. I shall be developing that thought in the course of the next hour. But by way of summary, let me quote from the catalogue of the exhibition currently showing in Ottawa, John Ruskin, Artist and Observer. Ian Jeffrey, in an essay on Ruskin as photographer, cites his daguerreotype of the Badia at Fiesole near Florence. This is not actually the daguerreotype, unfortunately. I couldn't get hold of a copy of it, but it's the same view as the, roughly the same view that you see in the daguerreotype. The facade of the Badia is by the great Filippo Brunelleschi, the 15th century architect, who is normally credited with having launched the classical architecture of the Italian Renaissance with its symmetries, balance, and humanistic proportions. Ruskin admired precisely those aspects of this facade, which are not in the strict sense classical at all. Brunelleschi was, of course, in his origin, a Gothic artist. And the contrasting features of the design, which you can see in the blank arcading on either side of the door, are quite different. And this is what Ruskin admired. Jeffrey, in his essay, succinctly comments, and he says it so neatly that I will quote it rather than summarize it myself. This quote is on your sheet. Ruskin's idea was that in worthwhile architecture, no two modules, panels, or carved ornaments should ever be the same. If they are slightly dissimilar, it is a sign that they've been made by hand and not by machine, which is a good thing and acknowledges the workman as a creator. Irregularity also implies change, which Ruskin valued above stasis, and perfection destroys expression, checks exertion, and paralyzes vitality. It was this idea of Ruskin's that seized the 19-year-old William Morris reading The Nature of Gothic soon after its publication, and it set him on the course of his future life. Morris is notoriously the champion of handicraft over machinery, though contrary to legend, he did use machinery for specific purposes. So the second thing Stuart Mitchell reminded me of was Morris and a famous aphorism of his, it's on your sheet, have nothing in your houses that you do not know to be useful or believe to be beautiful. To give a quite different example from my Ruskinian travels, last summer I had the good fortune to spend an afternoon in one of the loveliest buildings I know. I just flashed up another picture of Mitchell's work. It's not relevant to what I'm saying. I was attending a seminar about Ruskin at, appropriately enough, the University of Venice, which is based in one of the finest of the Grand Canal palaces, Ca' Foscari, which is to say, Foscari House. Ruskin himself describes Ca' Foscari as the noblest example in Venice of the 15th century Gothic. I'll say something about it. Francesco Foscari, who had the house built for his family, went on to become doge, and then to live in an even more beautiful house, which all of you will recognize, the Ducal Palace, which Ruskin called, with characteristic hyperbole, the central building of the world. If you're traveling by boat in the direction of the Ducal Palace, you will see Ca' Foscari on the right-hand side of the canal, just at the point where the water makes its most dramatic swerve towards the left, the optimal site for a great building. And if you're accustomed to looking for such things, you'll notice that unlike most of its rival palaces, it has not one piano nobile, but two. What is a piano nobile? I'm sure most people know. It's a floor, the floor of an Italian palace, where the main reception area is located, which is usually on the first floor. And it's given prominence by the grand architectural arrangement of its windows, their mouldings, and their sculptural ornament. To build a house with two piani nobili was presumably to show off in a big way, and Foscari seems to have wanted the world to notice him and his power and property. He was doge from 1423 to 57. His reign, which ended in a legendary disaster, is generally regarded by historians as marking the transition in Venice from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance, and from unrivaled greatness to steady decline. Ruskin associated him with the point in history at which Venice fell from grace. But he did admire the house and the work of its architect generally. And I want to say something about that architect, who was almost certainly a man named Bartolomeo Bon. He was born around 1400 and died at some time after 1464. His name ought to carry more resonance than it does, because he also worked on the Ducal Palace itself. He designed the Porta della Carta, which links the palace with St. Mark's Basilica. And he and his father Giovanni collaborated with the architect Marco Raverti on the most famous of all the Grand Canal palaces, the Ca d'Oro, or House of Gold. I mean, these three palaces are probably the most beautiful buildings in Venice. And that his name is not well known, except to lovers of Venetian architecture, is probably due to two interesting things. First, before the mid-16th century, Venetian citizens weren't expected to attract fame to themselves. Their glory was to be in the fame which they brought to Venice, a principle a certain number of contemporary architects might observe to our benefit. Secondly, I've called Bartolomeo an architect because that's the obvious modern word for him, but he's probably better described as a master mason. He belonged to a family of masons, which is to say craftsmen who worked in stone, whether as builders, sculptors, or designers. It wasn't
unusual for such workmen to collaborate with others, as in the case of the Car d'Oro. The Bonn family workshop was probably brought in to complete that building after Raverti, who was not a Venetian, had for some reason or other moved on. So it was regarded as perfectly reasonable for another architect to take over after the first one. And of course, a whole collection of artists worked on the Ducal Palace over a period of about 300 years. It might fall to such a man as Bartolomeo, especially because he must have acquired distinction and respect, that he would draw up plans for the whole of a building. But that did not mean working from an architect's office, as it does today, and drawing the plans which working men have to then obey on site. On the one hand, other craftsmen, such as his father, must also have been involved in the design. It would not have been regarded merely as Bartolomeo's building, while on the other hand, much of the actual stonework may include stones laid by Bartolomeo himself and possibly even carved by him. For a 14th century person, any building of this quality would have been a collaboration between masons, some of whom were in their immediate function what we would think of as ordinary workmen. That we do know Bartolomeo's name probably indicates that the times were changing, that men of marked skill and inventiveness were beginning to rise above their lesser collaborators. 100 years later, such a man as Palladio, the architect of the Basilica of San Giorgio Maggiore, would be celebrated across the whole of Europe. Today, Palladio is arguably the most famous architect who has ever lived. And such a man as Bartolomeo does not enter the picture. To Ruskin, that only indicated that the world since 1500 had gone to the bad. The glorification of the individual artist was partly responsible for the so-called restoration of anonymous medieval buildings. It was all right to knock down and rebuild something that had no author responsible for it. This would not have applied to an artist like Palladio. In the late 1870s, both Ruskin and Morris campaigned to save the western facade of St. Mark's Basilica, the jewel of Venice itself, from this sort of vandalism. This picture, which Jim showed earlier by J.W. Bunny, is of the facade of St. Mark's, and that facade was about to be knocked down and rebuilt. And it was commissioned by Ruskin for the Guild of St. George at the time when he feared that it might be lost forever. In a letter of 1877, written in the course of that campaign, Ruskin protested at the detached dictatorial role of the modern architect. The modern system of superintendence from a higher social position, he wrote, renders good work impossible, and reminded his reader that he had written the Stones of Venice to show the dependence of its beauty on the happiness and fancy of the workman, and to show also that no architect could claim the title to authority of magister unless he himself wrought at the head of his men, captain of manual skill. And as he goes on to say, handling the chisel on sight. Magister, I will remind you, is the Latin word for what those Sheffield people call mester. And for Ruskin, an architect is a workman. The great sickness of modern society being, as you can see in the quotation framed by Tim, the distinction between the cultivated person who thinks and the uneducated person who works only with his hands. Quotation on your sheet, in fact, but I won't bother to read it now. Ca' Foscari was built at a high point in the story of Venetian art, which was, for Ruskin, a point from which things could only fall. Let's return to my afternoon in that beautiful building. And this is where I was sitting. The seminar was held in that room. It was a bright June afternoon, and the sun's reflection glared fiercely from the surface of the Grand Canal. To filter the light, there were blinds over the 8 windows. But being square, these blinds covered only the rectangular part. The Gothic heads, with their gorgeous ogival mouldings, were open to the light. And looking up from our table from time to time, I could see the fineness of the carving, intensely lit, the line as sharp and sinuous in its sweep as if it had just been cut. It was almost, I reflected, as if the sun were itself the chisel cutting those curves, and doing so as I sat there. How much of this, I wondered, was the work of Bartolomeo's own hand, and how much that of his fellow masons? Now, as it happens, Ruskin does not discuss Ca' Foscari in these terms, though in The Seven Lamps of Architecture, 1849, the book he wrote immediately before the Stones of Venice, there's a splendid engraving of one of the windows, which gives you some idea of his feelings about the workmanship. This is in Ruskin's youthful style, very romantic, with a sense of the building's age and frailty. His later work is more closely observant and less self-consciously atmospheric than this, but it's a fine illustration. Since Ruskin's day, the building has been heavily restored, which would have distressed him. He was worried about it when he made this drawing. And though the windows are said to be unchanged, I wonder if this one has not been a little recut. You see a slightly deader looking image there from what is otherwise a very beautiful photograph by Sarah Quill, the outstanding modern photographer of Venice. And at any rate, you can see that the beauty of the curves is still in evidence. They remind me of something Ruskin said about a much earlier building, the 12th century Basilica of San Zeno in Verona. In the first volume of The Stones of Venice, he describes a pair of slim marble shafts with concave capitals, one shaft straight, the other twisted. You see that there. The engraved plate he includes in illustration captures in his words, and I quote, "its singularly bold and keen execution, which gives the impression of its rather having been cloven into its form by the sweeps of a sword than by the dull travail of a chisel." Its workman, he says, was proud of it, as well he might be. He has written his name upon its front. I would that more of his fellows has been as kindly vain. And the goodly stone proclaims forever, "Ad hominis de Sancto Giorgio me fecit." Ad hominem of St. George made me. Well, in that expression, by the sweeps of a sword, Ruskin captures exactly what I felt about the bravura craftsmanship still visible from the piano nobile of Ca' Foscari. It's interesting that here too, the identity of the artist seems to have broken through the custom of anonymity. Ruskin is naturally curious about the identity of so accomplished a master, but he also admires a culture that normally cares so little for personal fame. Admires it because, oddly enough, as he read the history and the art, the relative insignificance of the artist was the necessary precondition for what he called, and I quote, "the life and liberty of every workman who struck the stone." It's a paradox. More of that in a minute. I have said in the course of speaking that Ruskin read a building. I think we've heard that expression about him before today. And what I was doing, I realized as I sat there in Ca' Foscari looking at the window arches, was reading, something that in fact Ruskin taught me to do. We can read buildings, Ruskin argues, just as we might read Milton or Dante, quote, getting the same kind of delight out of the stones as out of the stanzas. Once you have learnt to do such things and to read other things apart from buildings as well, pictures and even landscapes, for instance, life is never quite the same again. As Morris was one of the first to testify, an encounter with Ruskin can change your life. Reflecting on his own conversion to socialism, Morris wrote, quote, "It was through him, through Ruskin, that I learnt to give form to my discontent." We might compare the novelist Charlotte Bronte, who on reading the first volume of Modern Painters said she felt, quote, "as if I had been walking blindfold. This book seems to give me eyes." Many others have said similar things. Gandhi, for instance, Proust, Bernard Shaw, the most radical of British prime ministers, Clement Attlee, who admired Ruskin and Morris about equally. You will notice that of the two citations I have given, one is concerned with politics and the other with art. A sound understanding of Ruskin would explore not only this ability to change lives, but the connections between the diverse concerns that Ruskin brings together. Why, for instance, should an interest in architecture lead, as inexorably as it does in Ruskin, to social and economic questions? Ruskin had argued in The Seven Lamps of Architecture, which Jim was talking about earlier on, the book he wrote directly before The Stones, that buildings could be categorized by the quality of labor that went into them. Remember, was the artist happy? It is, if you think about it, labor that I have so far been talking about. The Sheffield Mester's knives and the carving of those Venetian windows. Ruskin, like Morris after him, does not make much distinction between art and labour. The lesson which Ruskin here teaches us, says Morris in his preface to The Nature of Gothic, is that art is the expression of man's pleasure in labour. I'll repeat that. The lesson which Ruskin here teaches us is that art is the expression of man's pleasure in labour. So art is the apotheosis of work. Making things and taking pleasure in it seems to be a distinctively human characteristic. And art is the talent for making things at its most refined and elevated level. It is noteworthy that even people who have never even given a thought to these issues nonetheless talk about works of art. It is there in our language, after all. But it's in The Stones of Venice, and most particularly in The Nature of Gothic, that Ruskin seriously begins to apply his mind to the matter. You will notice something comparable to his use of the word work occurring in the title of his book. Not buildings or architecture, he says, but the stones of Venice. Ruskin's first great intellectual interest as an adolescent was in the science of geology, particularly the geology of the Alps. And throughout his life, he studied and collected stones. So for him, just as all art begins in work, so architecture is first of all a matter of materials. this study by Ruskin of the baptistry in Florence is a study of two kinds of stone, and it's really as much a geological drawing as an architectural one. Now, I stress the word materials, Ruskin's concern with materials, which at first hearing may come as a surprise. Ruskin was a Christian and not at all a superficial one. But there's something in his thought that comes quite close to materialism in the Marxist sense. He distrusts pious language and likes to translate religious words into practical ones. He can't, for instance, abide the word holy. So when he quotes from the Bible, he changes it to helpful. And the parable of the talents in St. Matthew's Gospel, for instance, becomes a story, first of all, about, quote, plain money. When he writes about landscape paintings, he likes to talk about the natural phenomena represented in terms of their phenomenal existence outside the picture. He discusses their natural history, devotes most of the fourth volume of Modern Painters to what he calls, from a geological perspective, the materials of creation. This is not, in fact, contrary to Christianity, a religion whose central rite, after all, involves a meal of bread and wine. But it is rather at odds with those rarefied and sentimental versions of Christianity that gained ground during Ruskin's lifetime. What it means in practice is that Ruskin is not prepared to think of art as a privileged category, separate from the issues of life and society. Architects are stonemasons. Art is work. Aesthetic achievement is not separable from conditions of labour. Labour has a price in the market, and so on. You gradually come to see how natural it was that Ruskin in 1860, having just completed a five-volume book about art, which had occupied him for a great part of two decades, Modern Painters, should almost immediately settle down to write a book about economics. The outcome of this change of tack was his masterpiece Unto This Last. But of course, we tend not to think of architecture as art in quite the same way we think of painting or literature. Ruskin is aware of this. A picture or a poem, he writes in The Nature of Gothic, is often little more than a feeble utterance of man's admiration of something out of himself. But architecture approaches more nearly to a creation of his own, born of his necessities and expressive of his nature, unquote. That's to say, first, that our buildings tell us something about ourselves and our society, something that can be read in them. And it has to be said that most of the buildings I see going up around me today say very little about our society, certainly not if you compare them with, say, Venetian buildings of the 15th century. And second, that in the finished building we may read something about the life of the workmen who made it. The Nature of Gothic is a digression from the main course of the stones of Venice, a necessary one, as it turns out. But such digressiveness is characteristic of Ruskin. For those who admire him, the mark of his profundity, but a source of irritation to those who don't. What's more, included within the Nature of Gothic is a still more extraordinary digression, one which converts a work of art history temporarily into one of social philosophy. It is the combination of the two, I would argue, that gives the book its greatness. The Nature of Gothic comes between the chapter on Byzantine buildings and the chapter on Gothic ones in the middle volume of the stones. Venetian Gothic developed to a large extent from the Byzantine style that preceded it, and some would argue that it's hardly Gothic at all. It's an eclectic style which unites the Byzantine with elements of Islamic architecture and Northern Gothic. Gothic being a style that grows from the harsher conditions of life in Northern Europe, inappropriate in its pure form to the gentler ecology of the Mediterranean. You can see the difference in these two slides, a portal at Rouen Cathedral, for instance, in the north, and a portal from St. Mark's in the south. But for Ruskin, Venetian Gothic is Gothic because it exhibits not only the fundamental principles of Gothic design and construction, most obviously the pointed arch, but the outlook of the Gothic craftsman and his attitude to life. The outlook and attitude find expression in the building through the conditions of labour that enabled their construction. Or to put it another way, the workman's assumptions about life, enacted through his workmanship, find their expression in the building. Ruskin is not talking about some sort of philosophical expression. He's talking about something assumed in the building's configuration and detail. Since the Renaissance, Ruskin argues, the conditions of labour have altered. And that change has altered our buildings. The machine production of Victorian Britain is only the latest stage for him in a long process of dehumanization, a process culminating not merely in our reliance on machines, but in our willingness to turn human beings into machines. This leads him into the digression I referred to earlier. And I ask you to just follow this one on your sheet, his denunciation of the factory system, number 8. Men were not intended to work with the accuracy of tools, to be precise and perfect in all their actions. If you will have that precision out of them and make their fingers measure degrees like cogwheels and their arms strike curves like compasses, you must unhumanize them. Men may be beaten, chained, tormented, yoked like cattle, slaughtered like summer flies, and yet remain in one sense, and the best sense, free. But to smother their souls with them, to make the flesh and skin, which after the worms work on it is to see God, into leathern thongs to yoke machinery with, that is to be slave masters indeed. And there might be more freedom in England, though her feudal lord's lightest words were worth men's lives, and though the blood of the vexed husbandman dropped in the furrow of her fields, than there is, while the animation of her multitudes is sent like fuel to feed the factory smoke, and the strength of them is given daily to be wasted into the fineness of a web or racked into the exactness of a line. Such work, Ruskin is saying, is quite literally, and I use the word literally, such work is literally soul-destroying. If you read about the conditions endured, for instance, by metal workers in the Sheffield factories of Ruskin's lifetime, you will find no hint of exaggeration at all in that phrase, sent like fuel to feed the factory smoke. But Ruskin is not saying, as many have imagined, that employers in the Middle Ages were wonderfully kind to their workers and encouraged them to take up the arts and crafts and no doubt be nice to animals. He readily admits that it was often a brutal time, careless of much ordinary human suffering and habituated to casual death. But the modern form of compassion, rooted in a system of production that before it does anything else deprives us of our humanity, is powerless to rectify
the depth of that injustice. The evil for Ruskin is simple. Industrial workers have become like the builders of the Egyptian pyramids, as the Victorians imagined them, slaves. He talks about the glossy mechanical perfections of the 19th century drawing room, and it may remind us even more of the glossy perfections of our own, the accurate mouldings and perfect polishings and unerring adjustments of the seasoned wood and tempered steel. These are marks of the bondage in which the working man lives. In Gothic, however, says Ruskin, it was otherwise. And I quote, this quote on your sheet, number 10, I think. In the medieval, or especially Christian, system of ornament, this slavery is done away with altogether. Christianity having recognized, in small things as well as great, the individual value of every soul. But it not only recognizes its value, and this is the point I began with, really, it confesses its imperfection in only bestowing dignity upon the acknowledgement of unworthiness. And it is perhaps the principal admirableness of the Gothic schools of architecture, that they thus receive the results of the labor of inferior minds. And out of fragments full of imperfection, and betraying that imperfection in every touch, indulgently raise up a stately and unaccusable whole. It's easy to misread this, I think. Ruskin is not praising individualism, and he's not praising self-expression in the bourgeois liberal sense, nor is he encouraging slapdash approximations of craftsmanship. As a matter of fact, he's saying much the same thing as Stuart Mitchell said to me about his knives in Sheffield. But he's also thinking in terms of the traditional Christian account of human nature, as St. Augustine or Dante, for instance, would have understood it. Our work must be imperfect because we are imperfect. But it is one of the great paradoxes of Christian teaching that this fallen condition becomes, in effect, our greatest glory. It is what theologians call the felix culpa, the fortunate fall, since it makes salvation possible. The doctrine is most famously evoked at the end of Milton's Paradise Lost, when Adam and Eve, mourning the loss of Eden, realize that the world is all before them. For in falling, they walk into the condition of being human, imperfect, sinful, and therefore driven to greatness. It is a very dynamic view of human nature and creation. And in evoking it, Ruskin captures the fierce energy of Gothic, as in that facade of Reims Cathedral. He recalls such a facade with its teeming decoration, those ugly goblins and formless monsters and stern statues, anatomy-less and rigid, are signs of the life and liberty of every workman who struck the stone, a freedom of thought and rank in the scale of being, which it must be the first aim of all Europe at this day to regain for her children. I've not been the first person today to read that quotation. We may notice in that last sentence a subtle change of tone. Entirely consistent with what he's been saying, the rhetoric now begins to sound less like St. Augustine and more like, perhaps, a modern revolutionary. This is the Ruskin who can speak of himself in one and the same book as a Tory and a communist. The individual value of every soul is to be understood in a social context. The Gothic architect is in fact a mason, primus inter pares,
The building is to be read as a social construct, as a work of collaboration, as the coming together of individual imaginations. And it's here we must obviously grant entry to my second subject, William Morris. Those of you who know John Morris will already be calling to mind his fictional stonemasons, which we heard about earlier, the brother and sister in the early prose romance, The Story of an Unknown Church, which Tim quoted from. And it may also think of the female stonemasons known as the obstinate refusers in his utopian romance, News from Nowhere. They, you may remember, are so absorbed in their work that they refuse to join in the haymaking festival, the joy they take in the work providing sufficient satisfaction. In 1858, when Morris and his Pre-Raphaelite friends, in a similar spirit of carnival, were frescoing the walls of the newly built Oxford Union, designed by the Irish architect Benjamin Woodward, they cannot have failed to wander a few hundred yards up the road to watch the building of a still more ambitious structure by Woodward again himself, the Oxford Museum of Natural History, a project of Ruskin's, inspired by him and built according to his scheme. The building was to have been the most intellectually rich and complex of all neo-Gothic buildings, with an elaborate portal like a cathedral's, the multitudinousness of nature expressed in teeming sculptural decoration. Sadly, it was never completed, though it survives today as a fully functioning museum of considerable beauty. Morris would certainly have watched with fascination the reappearance in modern England of Gothic stonemasons as Ruskin had described them. There they were, cutting directly into the stone on site. For it had been in the nature of Gothic when he read it as an undergraduate that Morris discovered the purpose of his life. And the craftsman engaging directly with his material had become Morris's model of human labour, redeemed by the exercise of skill and imagination. But to return to Morris in 1853, the year of the nature of Gothic, he had just gone up to Exeter College, Oxford, where he met his lifelong friend, the painter Edward Burne-Jones. The two young men, both destined for the church, were already passionate medievalists. Reading The Nature of Gothic gave practical substance and intellectual rigour to their dreams. And after a tour of the French cathedrals on a summer holiday, they abandoned their original vocations, resolving to become, in Burne-Jones's case, a painter, and in Morris's, an architect. Architecture was quickly to prove the wrong choice for Morris, but for the rest of his life, it provided the context within which he worked as a designer. On the way, it led him into a friendship with the architect Philip Webb, who was able to turn Morris's dream of a Gothic home into reality, and thereby, in effect, kick off the arts and crafts movement in architecture. This is Morris's home, Red House, designed in 1859, just as the Oxford Museum went into service. So both those buildings belong to the same period. And like the Oxford Museum, it is at once Gothic and ultra-modern. The story goes that, unable to find furniture to suit the house, Morris, Webb and Burne-Jones, getting their wives and their friends in the Pre-Raphaelites Brotherhood into service, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, Ford Madox Ford, and so on, decided to make their own furniture. And from doing so, the firm of Morris, Marshall, Faulkner and Company was born. And that, in turn, was eventually to become the famous Morris and Company. Morris was unbelievably fertile and prolific. It's possible to isolate some 13 or 14 crafts that he mastered in less than 40 years of creative work, quite apart from being a poet and a political activist as well. But happy as he was to be engaged in such work and profitable as he found it to be, he was also frustrated. At the Oxford Museum, Ruskin had discovered that you couldn't create a truly Gothic building without a Gothic society. To take a couple of simple examples, he would have liked Rossetti and other artists he knew to come and decorate the museum with ambitious frescoes, as Giotto might have done, or sculptures like the sculptures of Rouen or Chartres. But Rossetti had to earn a living, and he could only do that by painting easel pictures which wealthy individuals, most of them capitalists, could afford to buy. He was too poor to give up a couple of years to working on such a project. So the artists Woodward used were mostly less able than those he would have wanted. The sculptor that you saw there and his brother, the brothers O'Shea, in Ruskin's view, turned out not to have been well trained enough and to rely too much on inspiration. So that the ambitious schemes that Ruskin had for the Oxford Museum, such as that for the Great Portal, had to be shelved. The issue was an economic one. And the most important effect of it for Ruskin was that it led him away from his main focus on art and turned him into a social critic. Most notably, of course, in his attack on the political economists. Morris's disenchantment took longer than Ruskin's and was more complex, and in the end, the response was more extreme. He was led away from his social concerns through association with non-political artists, and his eventual turn to politics in the late 1870s was partly an effect of his gradual alienation from Rossetti. When in 1883 he joined what was soon to become the Social Democratic Federation, he wrote to Ruskin asking him to do the same. Ruskin refused. He was not a joiner anyway. Not a joiner. Wasn't prepared for that one, Tim. He was not a joiner anyway, and neither a Democrat nor a socialist. But Morris was conscious that in taking this step, he was continuing on a road that Ruskin had opened up for him. 9 years later, sorry, this is Red House again, but 9 years later, he published an edition of The Nature of Gothic at the Kelmscott Press. It is a beautiful volume in Morris's Roman font, the Golden Type, and the preface he wrote for it is one of his most moving testimonies. When he first read Ruskin's essay, he wrote, and this is number 6 on your sheet, when he first read that essay, now many years ago, it seemed to point out a new road on which the world should travel. And in spite of all the disappointments of 40 years, and although some of us, John Ruskin amongst others, have since learned what the equipment for that journey must be and how many things must be changed before we are equipped, yet we can still see no other way out of the folly and degradation of civilization. For the lesson which Ruskin here teaches us is that art is the expression of man's pleasure in labor, that it is possible for man to rejoice in his work. For strange as it may seem to us today, there have been many times when he did rejoice in it. And lastly, that unless man's work once again becomes a pleasure to him, the token of which will be that beauty is once again a natural and necessary accompaniment of productive labor, all but the worthless must toil in pain, and therefore live in pain. I can see little in that passage with which Ruskin would not have in principle concurred. But I'm not sure he would have agreed that the road on which the world should travel was entirely a new one. Ruskin told Sidney Cockerell that Morris was, quote, beaten gold, and as we heard earlier today, the ablest man of his time. While Morris, on the other hand, regarded Ruskin as the chief inspiration of his life. Yet the strange thing is that the two men never seemed to have achieved an intimate friendship. This must have been partly because their aims and tastes were not identical. Morris was suspicious of the Italian art and architecture that Ruskin loved, and preferred the uneventful landscapes of southern England to the alpine and lakeland landscapes that inspired Ruskin. Ruskin, moreover, was at root an ethical Tory, even if at times that made him sound like a Marxist. Morris was a Marxist, at any rate in the last years of his life, and perhaps imagined Ruskin to be more left-wing than he actually was. At any rate, the new road that Ruskin had pointed out led, in Morris's view, to revolution and socialism. The image of the medieval artisans labouring joyfully on their building site is for Morris an image of solidarity, or as he might have put it, fellowship. And it was by sinking the self in such collaborative endeavour that human beings might discover a purpose in life in the absence, as he saw it, of supernatural consolations. Ruskin's denunciation of the factory system, as many have noticed, anticipates the account of alienation given by Marx in the 12th chapter of Capital. And Ruskin shared Morris's view of man as a social animal whose genius functioned in acts of collaboration. But his conception of human beings working together in creative delight to raise up what he calls an unassailable whole also has a religious significance not superseded by fellowship. It is fallen humanity, imperfect but made in the image of the Creator, restoring the primal unity of things through a human act of creation. There is a paradox, of which Ruskin is intensely aware, that it is in our imperfection that we come closest to that basic pattern of creation. In a chapter which has come up several times in the course of today from the last volume of Modern Painters, he speaks of the law of help as the fundamental law of nature. The leaves on a tree, for instance, far from struggling for survival, as in the Darwinian theory, battling against one another, in Ruskin's view, collaborate with one another in the interests of the whole tree. Moreover, though all the leaves of, let's say, a chestnut tree are recognizable as chestnut leaves, no two of them are ever identical. As each of these different leaves contributes to the whole life of the tree, so each individual soul, with its individual value, contributes to a larger human entity, which the Gothic cathedral for Ruskin comes to symbolize. I suppose you could say that from a social perspective, both of these men were utopians. For Morris, as a lover of medieval art and culture, the past can provide a model for the future we may labour to create. An alternative, that's to say, to the way we live now. But Morris is not proposing that we should seek to replicate the Middle Ages or imagine that past eras can be relived. Nor does he mean
to idealize medieval life, even if on occasion he may seem to do so. Consider, for instance, his work as a designer, a famous tapestry created in collaboration with Philip Webb could not have been achieved without the example of medieval tapestries. Morris learnt the technique of tapestry making from medieval examples and from early modern primers. And there's much in the design of his woodpecker tapestry that recalls medieval work. But there's never any risk of mistaking it for a medieval tapestry. It's quite clearly a modern one. Or take this further example, a stained glass window in Cambridge, modelled on the 13th century work in Merton College, Oxford, which is like that. Actually, in lots of ways, to our eye, not remotely similar. Nicholas Pevsner, writing in praise of Morris, observed acutely that, quote, he looked on the Middle Ages rather for guidance than for actual paradigms. So the difference of the past from the present becomes a way of conceiving a better future. Ruskin's utopianism is qualitatively different. His medieval Venice is an ideal society which helps to account for the gorgeous artifacts that survive from that great era. But this idealization helps Ruskin to understand how the art a society produces must be a reflection of its values. The equation is not altogether accurate. The reading is slightly skewed. But the contemplation of a past utopia, that's not a contradiction in terms, helps him to imagine how our society might become a better one. The image of Gothic creativity he gives in his great essay has been in modern times much criticized. We are told, for instance, that medieval building sites were intensely hierarchical, and the craftsmen Ruskin praised as if they were modern artisans were actually the aristocrats of their profession, that the ordinary labourers were miserably paid and suffered from respiratory diseases caused by dust, that anyway the work on a cathedral, of all things, cannot be taken as a model of medieval labour. And no doubt some of all this is true in some degree. But as one of the most trenchant of the critics who have pointed this out has observed, a man named John Unrau, the nature of Gothic shows what all human work could be if all were united in a fellowship of free artistic endeavour. I reflect that these matters have preoccupied me now for nearly 50 years. But it was only last year, as I sat in that seminar by the Grand Canal, that I think I began to grasp inwardly, or so I like to think, what Ruskin had done. An able but imaginative craftsman, an able but unimaginative craftsman may produce adequate work on a functional building of nugatory aesthetic merit. The work of such a craftsman earns a living. Equally, a computer can measure and plan with an accuracy unknown to the human hand or eye, operated, for instance, by such a designer as the Italian architect Renzo Piano. Who has recently produced this building, the Shard, near London Bridge, the tallest building in Europe. Piano is the most environmentally conscious of modern architects and a master of high tech. Seen as I saw the Shard recently at sunset, reflecting the light of an early moon, it can be hauntingly beautiful. But at the same time, it is a building that seems never to have been touched by the human hand. One should be grateful for such beauty,
But what about the aesthetic merits of the building of the buildings it overshadows, most of them unbelievably dismal? Moreover, an office block towering over one of the world's chief financial centres, looking like a spire, cannot help but be read as a cathedral to capital, affirming the triumph of high finance and high technology over the individual souls, to use Ruskin's phrase, in the streets below. What Ruskin sees in good architecture is a bond between the human spirit and the natural world, and the human presence can be read in the cut stone. We need to rediscover the simple lesson about hand and eye, taught me by the Sheffield Mester I began this lecture with. The political future of our planet, as I'm sure you agree, is more puzzling today than it must have been at any time since the French Revolution. It is hard for us to talk, as Morris could, about any road on which the world should travel. We could do worse, however, than do what he did in 1853, and ask what it means for a chisel to carry a human intention into a slab of marble, itself a thing of unreachable beauty, and what such a cut may tell us of civilization and work and, of course, human happiness. Thank you for your attention.